You're listening to the Uncle Sam and the Swastika KFJC Memorial Day Special, and you're in the middle of listening to the original Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast done by myself and my former co-host Mark Ortiz on KPFA on May 23rd, 1980. Broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC Los Altos Hills. Don't forget, we're going all the way up till 10 a.m. 10 a.m., yeah. Okay, we're going all the way up till 10 p.m. this evening with the Uncle Sam and the Swastika Special. So be tuned in and be ready to tape all the way till 10 o'clock this evening. This next side is 45 minutes in length, and we'll resume from where the previous side left off. Those of you who are taping, this is 45 minutes in length. 3, 2, 1, here we go.
The information cabled would include the name of the ship, the sailing date, the cargo carried, the destination, and the value of the insured property. One detail that should have raised someone's eyebrow but did not until the government stepped in was the fact that the Zurich Group in turn had a reinsurance treaty with the Munich Reinsurance Pool in Germany. The result was that during 1940 and early 1941, by the time a ship had cleared New York or Baltimore Harbor headed for a European port, the German intelligence service already had the sailing data in hand. When men from the Department of Justice called a conference of insurance representatives, the companies agreed to stop sending such information by cable. But even then, no one realized what an efficient pipeline the Germans had set up. It appeared later that everyone concerned, both government officials and insurance men, assumed that sending the information by mail to Switzerland would be perfectly all right. Nothing was said about stopping completely the transmission of reinsurance information. In the spring of 1942, after we had started to set up the economic warfare section, we found that reinsurance information sheets, or bordereaux, B-O-R-D-E-R-A-U-X, were still going to Switzerland by mail. We also discovered that the reinsurance business, far from being confined to ships and cargoes, also covered industrial plants, and more especially those very large new plants being built for war production, the ones with security guards at the gates to see that no unauthorized eyes got inside. In the case of industrial plants, we found that the reinsurance bordereau did not account for the full extent of the leakage. The usual reinsurance treaty on such risks provides that the reinsurance group has the right to demand copies of a full report by the insurance respector. This report includes blueprints of the installation, description of the fire hazards and risks, and inventory of the contents of the buildings room by room. We found that before 1938, the Zurich Group had asked for the full insurance inspector's report in only 5 or 6% of the cases. After 1938, the full report was requested with increasing frequency until a percentage was closer to 90. It had seemed obvious to us that the government ought to stop this transmission of shipping and industrial information through Switzerland to the Reich. Unlike the United States, the German government as early as 1936 had closed off such information about Germany. As soon as the Germans occupied France, Belgium, and Holland in 1940, they put a stop to all such transmissions from those countries. We proposed to have the Attorney General send a letter to each company warning that transmission of marine and industrial plant information of this type came within the scope of the Espionage Act. Issuance of such a letter in the name of the Attorney General, however, required approval by the Solicitor General, Charles Fahey. Mr. Fahey would not take this responsibility without consulting the other interested departments of the government. At first, no one could believe that Americans were handing the German intelligence service information on a silver platter. At one of Mr. Fahey's interdepartmental meetings, Joseph Borken, then of the Antitrust Division, slapped down on the table a stack of insurance inspectors' reports on various prominent buildings. He had purchased these from sources open to anyone in the insurance business without any special security clearance. For 55 cents, he had the plans of the White House showing the location of the fire extinguishers and other protective apparatus. For 75 cents, he had the plans of a large new magnesium plant. One of the blueprints had an arrow pointing at a valve with a legend, "Under no circumstances must this valve be closed while the plant is in operation, as an explosion would result."
Well, In view of the Memorial Day weekend, I think it also bears saying that it's a tribute to the dedication and ability of American fighting men that we were able to win the war at all.
Before we wind up here, I'd like to mention one more book in addition to Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler and Who Financed Hitler, which is commonly available. One of James Stewart Martin's cohorts, one of his co-workers in the economic warfare section of the Department of Justice, was a man named Joseph Borken, B-O-R-K-I-N. He wrote a superb book entitled The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben. Farben, by the way, is F-A-R-B-E-N. This was published by Pocket Books in 1979. So that's another book that you can consult in order to try and learn a little more about the events we've been talking about. And one of the reasons why people as a whole had the way in which it was buried was by appointing representatives of the very same interests which had financed Hitler and basically built up his war industry in the first place to the Allied bodies in charge with the responsibility of investigating the German war economy. James Stuart Martin writes about the frustrations which his group met in attempting to evaluate German war-making industry and the causes of those frustrations. He writes, "We settled down out of the sky over England into a fog-covered beehive called Bushy Park, headquarters for the future military government of Germany, then known as the U.S. Group Control Council. Brigadier General Cornelius W. Wickersham was in command, and it was on our way to report to him that we got our first forewarning of opposition to come. Together with Norman Bursler and Alexander Sachs, I was walking through the hall of a temporary wooden office building when Alex pointed to the name of Colonel Graham K. Howard over the office door of the Director of the Economics Division. Howard was the author of a book written in 1940 before the United States entered the war called America and a New World Order, an apologia for the Nazi economic system that might just as well have been titled You Can Do Business with Hitler. Now it looked as though we were to be working with him and others like him in an effort to reconstitute Germany on a new pattern. Colonel Howard was only the first of many who turned up, riding into Germany with a future military government, helping to deflect the policy back into the old grooves. Colonel Howard, it is true, was straightaway relieved of his duties before we left Bushy Park for the continent. In fact, just after General Wickersham received a copy of his book from the Intelligence Division. But trick pennies are the same on both sides. The position of economic director was filled by the assignment from Washington of Brigadier General William H. Draper, Jr., on military leave from his position as Secretary Treasurer of Dillon, Reed & Company. This investment banking firm after World War I had taken the lead in floating the German bonds which put German industry in a position to fight another war. The men with whom Colonel Howard had already staffed the Economics Division clearly wanted the occupation of Germany to be carried out along quite different lines from those decided upon by the government departments at Washington. Coordination between the plans of the Economics Division and the policies laid down by Washington became more and more difficult. The constant carping and the mounting criticism of the official policies became so open that General Wickersham finally found it necessary to issue a formal order to all officers under his command, requiring them to stop their criticism and to support and advocate the policies laid down in the Joint Chiefs of Staff directive. Our special team was assigned to work in the Finance Division with Captain Norbert A. Bogdan, a charming fellow who had been a vice president of the J. Henry Schroeder Banking Corporation, a firm in whose files the Nazi banking affiliations were still warm when the United States went to war. Anthony C. Sutton, in the book we told you about earlier, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, further discusses the makeup of the U.S. Group Control Council, developing further upon what James Stuart Martin said. He quotes from a memo written by Treasury Secretary Morgenthau to President Truman on May 29, 1945. He writes, "Lewis Douglas, whom General Clay describes as my personal advisor on economical, financial, and governmental matters." And that apparently is not a sentence. Douglas resigned as director of the budget in 1934, and for the following 8 years, he attacked the government's fiscal policies. Since 1940, Douglas has been president of the Mutual Life Insurance Company, and since December 1944, he has been a director of the General Motors Corporation. Edward X. Zdunke is to supervise the engineering section. Prior to the war, Mr. Zdunke was head of General Motors at Antwerp. Philip Gettke is to be in charge of mining operations. Gettke was formerly connected with Anaconda Copper and was manager of its smelters and mines in Upper Silesia before the war. Philip P. Clover is to be in charge of handling oil matters. He was formerly a representative of the Saucony Vacuum Oil Company in Germany. Peter Hoagland is to deal with industrial production problems, and Hoagland is on leave from General Motors and is said to be an expert on German production. The memo concludes with some information which further develops the background of Graham K. Howard, author of America and a New World Order. Secretary Morgenthau writes, "One of the men who helped General Draper in the selection of personnel for the Economics Division was Colonel Graham Howard, a vice president of General Motors who was in charge of their overseas business and who was a leading representative of General Motors in Germany prior to the war. Howard is the author of a book in which he praises totalitarian practices, justifies German aggression and the Munich policy of appeasement, and blames Roosevelt for precipitating the war. Well, as you might well imagine, the presence of these interests on the U.S. Group Control Council enabled the American financial and industrial concerns that had worked with Nazi Germany to hide their involvement. Interestingly enough, it also guaranteed that their German associates would be returned to important positions in the post-war reconstruction of Germany, as they were. Because, see, if the victors had dealt too harshly with the vanquished, their own role in the creation of the conflict would have been revealed, and so they covered it up. Before we conclude, in evaluating the forces that had led to the defeat of his group's efforts to bring about German reform, James Stuart Martin feared two things. First, he was afraid that the return to power of Hitler's industrialists would lead to a resurgence of Nazism in Germany. And more importantly, Martin noted that the same pattern of economic concentration that led to the ascendance of Hitler in Germany was already evident in the United States in 1950, and he expressed his fear that this concentration of power might lead to the rise of Nazism in this country. Martin concludes All Honorable Men by discussing the economics of fascism and his fears for both Germany and the U.S.
Dave and I are going to take turns reading you James Martin's conclusion in All Honorable Men. First, though, we'd like to remind you that we're reading a book written in 1950, and some of Martin's references to German Reconstruction date this text. However, we both feel that Martin's message about the dangers inherent in economic concentration is still as valid as ever.
Proceeding with the conclusion of All Honorable Men, James Stuart Martin writes, "After 2.5 years, I came back from Germany quite well aware that I had been wrestling with a buzzsaw. We had not been stopped in Germany by German business. We had been stopped in Germany by American business. The forces that had stopped us had operated from the United States, but had not operated in the open. We were not stopped by a law of Congress, by an executive order of the President, or even by a change of policy approved by the President or any member of his cabinet. In short, whatever it was that had stopped us was not the government, but it clearly had command of channels through which the government normally operates. The relative powerlessness of governments in the face of growing economic power is, of course, not new. Between the two world wars, the outstanding development in world economics was the division of territories and markets, a private agreement among the largest corporations of Britain, Germany, and the United States, with minor participations by their counterparts in France, Italy, and Japan. National governments stood on the sidelines while bigger operators arranged the world's affairs.
We have the same difficulty today. What we need is to be able to have a government that controls economic power instead of becoming its tool. Since power is a public trust, including economic power, the first job of a government is to see that the power is used in the public interest and not against it. By chartering a private corporation, a government delegates to the corporate body some of its own power to regulate commerce. Strictly speaking, this is an abdication by the government. It is time to view the results of this abdication by constitutional governments in favor of private governments. The occupation of Germany has already provided a good laboratory in which we could study the activities of self-centered corporations and the activities of a German national government in which these corporate combines had a dominant influence.
The eco-political masters of Germany boosted Hitler and his program into the driver's seat at a time when the tide in the political fight between the Nazis and the supporters of the Weimar Republic was swinging against the Nazis. All of the men who mattered in banking and industrial circles could quickly agree on one program and throw their financial weight behind it. Their support won the election for the Nazis. We must assume that the same thing is not yet true in the United States. We do have economic power so concentrated that it would lie in the power of a group of not more than 100 men, if they could agree among themselves, to throw the same kind of combined economic weight behind a single program. They have not agreed yet. There are still enough divisions within the Republican Party and enough minor differences between Republicans and Democrats to indicate that on some fundamental economic questions there are different points of view, each one championed by a different faction inside the financial and industrial community itself. If the United States should run into serious economic difficulties, however, most of the conditions for a reenactment of the German drama would already exist on the American stage. The slight differences within the camp of the fraternity then may be the only real barrier to the kind of integration of the financial and industrial community behind a single repressive program like that which the financiers and industrialists of Germany executed through Hitler. Are we safe in assuming that it would take a grave economic crisis to precipitate the dangers inherent in economic concentration? The basic integration of a financial and industrial groups in the United States is evident when we look at the increase of concentration in the past few years.
Our job now, then, is to prepare for a future crisis before it happens. This means that in Germany we must have a double objective. The occupation of Germany must be put back on the track. But more than that, we have to reassert public goals in the United States, which will prevent the already apparent concentration of economic power in our own country from reaching the end it did in Germany. We cannot hope to deal with the concentration of economic power in Germany until we are able to deal with the concentration of economic power in the United States. This brings the German problem home with an urgency that has been missing in most post-war discussions about Germany. The need to treat Germany as an American problem was not felt in this country after World War I. Despite warnings from men whose experience with the German occupation had convinced them that we were entering a period of armed truce and not peace, business arrangements went ahead unchecked to rebuild a Germany that could not be expected to be anything but a steamroller. Now, with all that experience and warning behind us, and in spite of strong popular support for the reform of Germany, we have had to watch the same errors being repeated as if nothing else were possible. The moral of this is not that Germany is an inevitable menace, but that there are forces in our own country which can make Germany a menace. And more importantly, those forces could create a menace of their own here at home. Not through a deliberate plot to bring about a political catastrophe, but as a calm judgment of business necessity. The men who might do this are not Nazis, but businessmen. Not criminals, but honorable men.
This concludes Shouting Out for this afternoon. I'd like to personally thank Mom O'Shea and everyone connected with KPFA for providing us with this opportunity. My name is Dave Emery.
I'm Mark Ortiz. Thanks for listening.
Today is August 12, 1990, and I'm going to make an addendum to Uncle Sam and the Swastika. By way of introduction, I'm going to begin by reading a short section from The Californian magazine. Research credit on this, by the way, goes to a listener. And in The Californian magazine from October of 1961, there's a section here talking about a response to an article that they did talking about the reinstitution of Nazism and or Nazi officials and the Nazi structure in West Germany following the conclusion of World War II. That is documented at great length in Radio Free America program number 2, available from our archives on audio. Now, reading from the Californian magazine from October of 1961, more than 2 years before President Kennedy was killed, we find the following. It's entitled, Nazis Mad at Us. Following publication of the Californian's material on Nazism in West Germany, a crudely printed poster came through the mail with the following words in red and blue ink. We promise, Trotz Judenneid und Hass Geschule ein geeintes Deutschland. The translation of this is, we promise, in spite of the envy by Jews and cries of hatred, a unified Germany. It was accompanied by an ad for a book glorifying the SS. Well, now in August of 1990, a unified Germany has indeed taken place. And in a footnote to the dire warning sounded at the end of Uncle Sam and the Swastika, by the way, we echoed James Stewart Martin's words from 1950. We echoed those words in 1980. And now in 1990, we find a very, very chilling development. One of the
major topics of discussion in Uncle Sam and the Swastika was the IG Farben Company, that is short for Interessengemeinschaft Farbenindustrie. That was the German dyestuffs cartel, the chemical cartel, which provided the backbone of German industrial production. It was instrumental in the rise of Hitler, and the member companies remained in place, as did the shell company after World War II. In addition to the Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast, we spoke about the IG Farben cartel and Radio Free America number 1, Radio Free America number 2. We discussed at a considerable length in a miscellaneous archive show called South Africa, the Third Reich and the Bomb, documenting connections between the IG, the West German nuclear industry, and in turn connections between the South African nuclear industry and that of West Germany. And we also touched on IG Farben and Radio Free America program number 17, the end of the first broadcast in the five-part series about the shooting of the Pope, specifically talking about Deutsche Bank chairman Hermann Abbe's role in straightening out the Vatican banking scandals. He was selected by Carol Wojtyla, who served as a guest laborer in one of the concentration camps surrounding the Auschwitz concentration camp. Hermann Abbe's being a member of the board of directors of IG Farben, who helped to put forth the venture capital for... Actually, I don't know if he was a director of IG Farben. I believe he was. He certainly put forth the venture capital for building the Monowitz concentration camp, which used slave labor from Auschwitz. That's documented in Radio Free America 17. Also in Radio Free America number 24, we spoke about the role of the Bayer Company, one of the members of the IG, in developing first heroin, which was designed, ironically enough, as a cure for morphine addiction. They later designed what was first known as Dolefine, named in honor of Adolf Hitler, a synthetic narcotic developed to treat casualties during World War II, that later became known as methadone, now used, of course, to treat heroin addiction. IG Farben is one of the most important, if not the most important, industrial concerns in the entire world, and like Germany, it is coming back. And research credit on the following, and this is a chilling footnote here in August of 1990 to the warning sounded by James Stewart Martin in 1950, which we echoed 10 years ago in Uncle Sam the Swastika in May of 1980. Research credit on this goes to a listener. This is from the Sunday Times of London from July 29th of 1990. It's by Ian Jenkins, I-A-I-N, Jenkins, from Paris, and it's headlined, London Financiers Revive Jewish Gas Chamber Firm. Once again, London Financiers Revive Jewish Gas Chamber Firm. It reads as follows. S.G. Warburg, the City of London Merchant Bank, founded by emigre German Jews, has bought a significant stake in IG Farben, a German company the world thought had been killed off for its role in the Jewish Holocaust. Farben, which patented and manufactured the Zyklon B gas used to murder millions of Jews in the gas chambers and ran a slave labor camp near Auschwitz, is rising like a phoenix from its own ashes. For 40 years, the company has been nothing more than a dormant shell, its only task to compensate victims of its slave camp. But the destruction of the Berlin Wall has presented it with a chance of claiming back its huge industrial empire in East Germany and turning itself into a speculative vehicle. The possible resurrection of a name that is synonymous with the Holocaust has sent a shiver of disquiet through Jews throughout the world who thought the company had been buried forever. Eric Moonman, M-O-O-N-M-A-N, or Eric Moonman, senior vice president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews, said, quote, "This will cause considerable upset among Jews, not just in Britain, but throughout Europe," unquote. Ben Helsgott, H-E-L-S-G-O-T-T, a survivor of Buchenwald concentration camp and chairman of the Yad Vashem Trust, which teaches about the Holocaust, said Farben's name was forever associated with death. Again quoting, "I could not invest in this company even if it was the best bargain on earth," unquote, he said. It has, however, attracted the speculative interest of the City of London. Mercury Asset Management, the fund management arm of S.G. Warburg, Fidelity, the pensions group, and Morgan Grenfell, the merchant bank owned by Germany's Deutsche Bank, are among the British institutions that have bought into Farben recently. Other city institutions have done the same, and Farben's shares have risen from 20 Deutschmarks to 30 Deutschmarks. German brokers believe that city firms now own 40% of the company. None of the firms wanted its dealings publicized, but one shareholder said, quote, "We don't blacklist companies on the basis of what they did 30 or 40 years ago," unquote. Farben was the biggest industrial company in the world when the Second World War broke out and gave huge support to the Nazi war effort. It built a synthetic oil and rubber plant and had its own concentration camp staffed by the SS near Auschwitz, where slave laborers worked amid the smell of burning human flesh. An estimated 25,000 people, mainly Jews, died there. After the war, 23 of Farben's directors were tried at Nuremberg for war crimes. 11 were acquitted, and the rest sentenced to between 18 months and 8 years in jail. The Allies then broke up Farben. Bayer, BASF, Hext, and Agfa were stripped out of the company, leaving a property and investment shell with assets of about 150 million pounds. Its job was to compensate its Jewish slave laborers and then to liquidate itself. So far, it has paid $10 million in compensation, but there have been no recent claims. Farben, meanwhile, shows no signs of winding itself up. The other half of Farben's German assets were in the East and were confiscated without compensation by the Soviet-backed communist regime. Those assets, then worth 750 million pounds, could have a current value of 2 billion pounds. Quote, "We have already started to put claims in for these assets," says Carl Ehlerding, E-H-L-E-R-D-I-N-G, a director and one of the largest shareholders in Farben. In anticipation of this windfall, UK institutions started the speculative run on Farben's share price when a 20% block was bought by two leading city firms, apparently Mercury and Fidelity. And it credits additional reporting by Ian Burrell, B-I-R-R-E-L-L, and Helen Davidson. It's interesting, too, that the Farben, although obviously, as we've talked about in the past, the member companies of the IG remained in place. To that extent, the breakup of IG Farben was simply a farce, kind of like the alleged breakup of the Standard Oil Trust, although technically the old Standard Oil Trust in the United States was broken up. It remained in the hands of its ownership. Instead of Standard Oil, you had Mobil, which is Standard Oil of New York, originally Saucony Vacuum, then Saucony Mobil, Saucony standing for Standard Oil Company of New York. Exxon used to be S-O-E-S-S-O, or S-O for Standard Oil. Chevron is Standard of California. Amoco is Standard of Indiana. Sohio is Standard of Ohio. All of those continue to be owned, although they're publicly traded. The Rockefellers own a controlling interest. The same thing basically happened with IG Farben. We took a look at the alleged breakup of IG Farben in Radio Free America program number 2. It's interesting that the shell firm remained in place with assets of 150 million pounds to pay out compensations to the victims of its criminal activities during World War II. Only 10 million pounds were paid out, and apparently, according to this article, no recent claims have been filed. And again, I want to apologize for the somewhat rough reading here. There are a couple of editorial mistakes. Plus, again, I've been reading for almost 4 hours here. So that basically accounts for the bumpiness here. However, the real bumpiness is the fact that the IG has come back. It's back, and it is no longer safe to go in the water. Those people writing in 1961 made good on their promise. And as William Faulkner noted, the past is never dead and buried. It isn't even past. And it's worth noting that Only by understanding the past can we understand the present. Reviewing from Propaganda Review, spring of 1989, interestingly enough, in an article called Hitler's Last Laugh, there's a section here by Martin Lee, a well-known political researcher whose work we've used in the past, talking about a review of Blowback, the landmark book by Christopher Simpson. There's a little sidebar here called Cold War Habits Die Hard. The publication of Blowback showed once again that Cold War habits die hard at certain media. Although it was generally well received by reviewers, New York Times correspondent Serge Schmemann, S-C-H-M-E-M-A-N-N, belittled the book in the Times Sunday Book Review section. Without contesting Simpson's documentation, Schmemann accused Blowback of, quote, blurring the distinction between the means and the end, unquote, and, quote, smearing anti-communism with the taint of Nazism, unquote. Missing from Schmemann's review is a pertinent bit of biographical data. His father, the Reverend Alexander Schmemann, was deeply implicated in some of the CIA propaganda operations dissected and criticized at length by Simpson. An Orthodox Christian theologian and right-wing extremist, Father Schmemann gave weekly sermons on the CIA's radio liberation for more than 30 years. So, again, the past is never dead. It isn't even past. And apparently the New York Times, same people who published the Warren Report, do not want you to understand that past. If you understand the past, you can understand the present. If you don't understand the past, you cannot understand the present. As I've said so often, if you don't study history, the world is a mystery. Read or bleed, learn or burn.
This program, and for the benefit of people who hear this on tape, it is now May 24th, 1992, some 12 years after the original Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast, and 2 years, almost two years from the addendum that I did on August 12th of 1990, I thought it might be useful to take a look at the role of one of the financial institutions which has been centrally involved as part of the transatlantic, actually worldwide, industrial and financial axis, which not only undertook to bring fascism to Europe successfully and did so in Japan, but which was also deeply involved in efforts to bring fascism to the United States. What we're going to be taking a look at in this addendum is the role of the House of Warburg. The Warburgs are a prominent banking family, and they have branches in Germany, in Britain, and in the United States. And we're going to take a look at the role of the House of Warburg in the sustaining and creation of the various branches of IG Farben through the years. Now recall, in the addendum to Uncle Sam and the Swastika that I did on August 12th of 1990, I read a London Times article from July 29th of that same year talking about the role of British financial firms, including S.G. Warburg, a British financial firm that was founded by emigre German Jews. The Warburg family, ironically enough, were of Jewish extraction, and interestingly enough, in IG Farben, which is widely regarded as having been the backbone of German war manufacturing, of Third Reich war manufacturing, there were a great many Jewish families involved. One of the things that we want to take a look at in the broadcast this evening, as I said, is the role of the House of Warburg. Recall that in the July 29th, 1990, S.G. Warburg was involved with the revival of IG Farben almost half a century after World War II. What we're going to be looking at this evening is the role of the Warburgs in the original IG Farben in Germany in the 1920s, and we're going to take a look at the role of the House of Warburg, or elements thereof, in the establishment of the American branch of IG Farben, whose legal work was handled by the Dulles Law Firm of Sullivan and Cromwell. You heard about that in the original Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast. There is also something else to take note of. As I said, one of the interesting historical elements here is that the Warburg family is of Jewish extraction. There are, in fact, and have been some Jewish financial families, Jewish-owned financial firms involved in this transatlantic, actually worldwide, financial and industrial axis. This has often been distorted by neo-fascists and their apologists to be adapted into the old Jewish banking conspiracy, which is inherent in the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. That document inspired Henry Ford and Adolf Hitler, among others. It is also something which, unfortunately, one sees today. It is to be noted that the worldwide financial community is no more Jewish-owned today than it was in those days. I believe it's the 8 largest, perhaps the 10 largest commercial banks in the world today are Japanese. Something like 14 of the top 20 are Japanese. And there are at least two prominent German firms, the Dresdner Bank and the Deutsche Bank, which are among the top 20. And those are firms which were very closely affiliated with the Third Reich and don't have any Jews in them to speak of. But just as it's worth noting that the presence of Jewish-owned firms is what is well documented in this fascist industrial and financial axis that I have noted, it's important to note that neo-fascist apologists and right-wing conspiracy theorists often misconstrue this and distort it to, as I said, fit the mythology of the worldwide Jewish banking conspiracy. Nonetheless, it is worth noting that present in the milieu which brought fascism to Europe, helped bring fascism to Japan, and was working to bring fascism to the United States, there most definitely were Jews and Jewish-owned firms involved. It's also worth noting, too, that despite the fact that the Nazis had a doctrinaire anti-Semitic ideology, ultimately many of these wealthy Jewish financiers and firms were able to be incorporated into the Third Reich very, very nicely. Some of them became what were known as honorary Aryans, and the term means just what it says. Their Jewish background was overlooked if they had enough capital and if they were willing to play ball with the Third Reich, which a number of them were. It's also worth noting that in the 1920s, I.G. Farben proper, as we shall see in a minute, was being attacked by the Nazis because of the large number of prominent Jews that were involved with the firm. Nonetheless, I.G. Farben and Hitler became closer than sin by the early 1930s, as noted by James Stewart Martin in his conclusion to All Honorable Men that I read, that we read in the original Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast. I.G. Farben and some of the other firms affiliated with American industry and finance came to the aid of Hitler at a time when Nazi political fortunes were waning. One of the companies that did this was I.G. Farben, and despite the fact that the Nazis originally attacked I.G. Farben for the presence of Jews in its management structure, ultimately that was overlooked by the Nazis, and I.G. Farben became one of the cornerstones of the Third Reich, not only politically, but industrially. So take note of the fact that despite the doctrinaire anti-Semitism of the Nazis, they were and historically have been able to find common ground politically and economically with Jews, provided that they had enough capital and were willing to bend to the Nazi will. The Germans have a phrase which very accurately expresses this sort of realpolitik, in my opinion. The Germans have a phrase, Geheist ist Geheist, business is business. And when one begins to examine the world of big capital, one finds that generally ethnic and ideological considerations tend to be overridden by common interests regarding the manipulation of macro industry and macro finance. Macroeconomics, I guess you could say. The I.G. Farben's firm's full name was Interessengemeinschaft Farben Industry, the community of interests of the dyestuffs, literally. Farben is a German word for color. And it's worth noting that despite the initial or official enmity between Hitler and the Nazis and I.G. Farben, they became a community of interest, that is to say, the Nazis and I.G. Farben. And that is, as I said, an illustration of what the Germans refer to as Geheist ist Geheist, business is business, a principle one should not overlook. Now again, remember the presence of the S.G. Warburg firm at the heart of the revival of I.G. Farben in 1990. We're going to take a look first at the presence of the role of the House of Warburg in the original I.G. Farben company in the mid-1920s. Then we're going to take a look at the role of the House of Warburg in the establishment of American I.G., later renamed General Annalen and Film, in 1929. For our documentation, we're going to turn to a book alluded to in the original Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast. That book is entitled The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben. It's authored by Joseph Borkin, B-O-R-K-I-N, who was a colleague of James Stewart Martin's on the Justice Department, on the Economic Warfare section, actually the Economic Warfare section of the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice, the so-called bombing boys, that was headed up by James Stewart Martin, who you heard about in the original Uncle Sam on the Swastika broadcast. Joseph Borkin was one of his colleagues. This book was published in hardcover in copyright 1978 by the Free Press, which is a division of Macmillan and Company. Now again, what we're going to look at first is the initial enmity between I.G. Farben and Hitler and the Nazis because of the presence of a great many Jews at high levels of the I.G. management. And then we're going to take a look at how the anti-Semitic ideology of the Nazis and the practical business desires of I.G. Farben found common ground, and these two initially opposed entities became inextricably linked and worked together to the detriment of the human race. Take note again of the role of Max Warburg of the House of Warburg, and also take a look at how the IG here begins to find common interest with Hitler, and the two eventually become inextricably linked. Reading now from The Crime and Punishment of IG Farben. At this time, we're talking about the 1920s, late 1920s, at this time, an external problem menaced IG as Adolf Hitler grew in political strength. His attacks on industrial concerns in which Jewish officers and directors were readily identifiable became more ominous. IG Farben was a prime Nazi target as an, quote, instrument of international finance capital, unquote, dominated by such well-known Jews as Max M. Warburg, W-A-R-B-U-R-G, Arthur von Weinberg, W-E-I-N-B-E-R-G, Alfred Merton, M-E-R-T-O-N, Ernst von Simson, S-I-M-S-O-N, Otto von Mendelssohn-Bartholdy, and Kurt Oppenheim. Mendelssohn-Bartholdy is M-E-N-D-E-L-S-S-O-H-N-B-A-R-T-H-O-L-D-Y.
IG was cartooned as Isidore G. Farber, unquote, a grotesque caricature of Shylock, and IG Moloch, an ugly reference to the Canaanite god to whom children were sacrificed. IG officials were deeply troubled by these attacks and made an effort to stop them through a promising young IG employee with good Nazi connections, Heinrich Gatineau, press secretary to Duisberg. Henry Duisberg was a key IG official, and Heinrich Gatineau is the individual here to whom the Nazis turned, and eventually Gatineau, along with another IG official named Heinrich Beutefisch, was able to effect not only a rapprochement, but a very close marriage between IG and Hitler. Continuing, Gatineau had been the student of one of Hitler's favorite intellectuals, Karl Haushofer, the Nazi geopolitician. Haushofer is Haushofer. In fact, Gatineau had written his doctoral dissertation, The Significance of the Urbanization of Australia in the Future of the White Race, under Haushofer's direction. Skipping down, and now again we're talking about a meeting here between the aforementioned Heinrich Gatineau and Hitler, and also note the presence here of Heinrich Beutefisch, B-U-E-T-E-F-I-S-C-H, in this key meeting between the IG and Hitler. When Hitler arrived for his meeting with Beutefisch and Gatineau, he was obviously very tired. Too tired, the IG men feared, to understand so complex a matter as the hydrogenation of coal into oil. However, Hitler already knew about the process and was eager to discuss it. By the way, the hydrogenation process was one of the main elements that we discussed in the original Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast, and the standard IG agreement centered around the hydrogenation process. So that's what we're talking about here. Continuing. This last sentence. However, Hitler already knew all about the process and was eager to discuss it. Quoting Hitler, "Before you tell me your view, I would like you to hear my attitude on the whole problem. Today, an economy without oil is inconceivable in a Germany which wishes to remain politically independent. Therefore, German motor fuel must become a reality, even if this entails sacrifices. Therefore, it is urgently necessary that the hydrogenation of coal be continued." The meeting had been scheduled for only half an hour, but it went on for 2.5 hours, with Hitler pressing for detailed information on the conversion of coal into oil. As Gatineau later recalled, quote, "He surprised me again and again by his amazing understanding for technical matters," unquote. Before the meeting ended, Hitler had outlined a program under which he planned to make Germany self-sufficient in oil with the help of IG Farben industry. World War I had taught him that Germany's dearth of raw materials had rendered the British blockade a decisive weapon leading to Germany's defeat. By a program of self-sufficiency, he was determined to change Germany from a country deficient in natural raw materials into a self-sufficient military power. Hitler assured the IG visitors that their company could depend on his support, both financial and political. Gatineau and Beutefisch, elated by Hitler's response, reported back to Bosch. After hearing the entire story of the extraordinary meeting, Bosch remarked, "The man is more sensible than I thought," unquote. In the November 6th election, a few days later, the Nazis suffered a decisive setback. They lost 34 seats in the Reichstag, slipping to 196. The communists, on the other hand, gained 11 seats and now had a total of 100. German industrialists and financiers, more terrified by the communist advance than by the Nazi setback, came to Hitler's support at this critical moment. In fact, 38 of them did so publicly, including such powerful figures as Schock and Baron von Schroeder from banking, Kuno, C-U-N-O, from the German Lloyd Lines, Krupp, Vogler, and Thiessen from steel, and Siemens and Robert Bosch, Karl Bosch's uncle, from electrical engineering and manufacturing. But no IG personnel. Karl Bosch was not yet ready to make a public commitment. Hindenburg was unmoved by this coalition of financial and industrial strength. He chose Kurt von Schleicher instead, but Schleicher was unable to establish a stable government. Finally, on January 30th, Hindenburg capitulated and appointed Hitler chancellor. However, Hitler's hold on the office was tenuous. Another Reichstag election was scheduled for March 5th. On February 20th, Hjalmar Schacht, now among the most active members of the financial community supporting Hitler, called Germany's leading industrialists and financiers to a secret meeting at the home of Hermann Goering. This time, IG stood up to be counted. Among those present was Baron George von Schnitzler, one of the most important non-technical members of the IG managing board, and generally known as, quote, IG's salesman, unquote.
You're listening to the KFJC Memorial Day Weekend Uncle Sam and the Swastika Special. This is the original Uncle Sam and the Swastika program from May of 1980 with a number of different composites recorded in subsequent years.